This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 17th of December, 1951. The title of this lecture is Seriousness and Approval. This lecture is 58 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Arrow Productions.
If, as I stand here talking to you, and you start to see light through me or something, I start to disappear, call my attention to it, would you? I've just got through writing 2 books in 8 days. You know, when I was very young and frisky, I used to bat out about 100,000 words, 250,000 words a month. But when I began to totter and feel my teeth occasionally to make sure they were still real teeth, I got my speed down to about, 40, 50,000 words a month. Of course, didn't work at it very often. I noticed one day my typing speed had fallen off to maybe around 25, something like that. Well, I must have processed something. Actually, I was running weight. And I went in and sat down at the typewriter, and my speed was back at 90 words a minute. Now, I'm very interested in what takes place. We are taught very carefully that it is practice and muscular conditioning which gives one skill. Talking about self-confidence. In the matter of self-confidence, I ventured one day that all a person had to do was, if he had a very thorough self-determinism, is merely look at somebody, imitate his motions, step into his act, and promptly be able to hit the ball, bat the ball with a racket, whatever it was. What do you know about that? Typewriter speed jumped from about 25 to 90. There was no real trick getting these books out. My processing has been proceeding pretty well. Last time I came up here and talked to you, I was busy trying to walk with a 2-ton somatic. And I took some of the weight off of the thing, unburdened it a bit. It blew out. No great attention paid to it. It just blew out. We also have another sprint going forward. I turn out a manuscript, practically got a complete dummy on this book that was finished Tuesday, something like that. Everything is speeding up around here. It's going to get to a point where the minute will stop inflating like the dollar is. I've noticed that minute inflation is something attendant upon advancing years, shall I say. I've often heard people say, when I get older, why, there's less and less time in the day. And I remember back when I was a little kid, when a day dawned last year sometime, and good heavens, 4 o'clock in the afternoon was, you were so much older. Well, is it true that time does this sort of an accordion setup? That book, by the way, is the self-help book called Handbook for Preclears. And if you can get through the first few exercises of that live, you're a candidate for the Survivors Club. I'm going to have a Survivors Club here. And the Survivors Club membership will depend upon positive proof that an individual has gotten all the way through this handbook for preclears completely, doing every exercise. It has to be checked on. It's very easy to check whether or not a person's been through this book. If he's still there, and so forth. And if he looks like a human being, he hasn't been through it. Now, this book, by the way, is an expansion, but the pattern of the 15 acts of advanced procedures. The two books go together. Advanced procedures, what the auditor does for each act, and the self-processing book or handbook for pre-clears is what the individual, the pre-clear, does. And there's one act which very certainly requires auditor assistance, and that is the act which runs out the service facsimile, Act 10. The other act, a person very green at this business, might require a little coaching here and there, a little push once in a while. He's had the book 2 months, you haven't heard from him, and you find out that where the publisher neglected to cut an early page, that has not been separated yet. This book is going to make a very definite difference in this whole field. Matter of fact, advanced procedure already seems to have made some slight difference in the field. Dr. Osterkamp, he must be about 60. He's a MD, psychoanalyst. Quite an old boy. He studied with Freud. He was at an early auditor's class in Elizabeth. And one day I came in and I saw a student standing there and a student going like this and so on. And I said, "What's the matter with you?" He just kept on going like this. So I questioned the fellow who had been in the room with him, and somebody, he said, with a mustache and a goatee had been auditing this student, had looked at his watch and said, "It's about an hour and a half now. I have an appointment with another preacher. Come up to present time," and walked out, leaving this student in the middle of birth. So I wrote one of these notes in a ferocious hand, letters about that high, and I said, "Notice to Dr. Osterkamp, do not leave students stuck in birth on these premises." Well, Osterkamp came around looking very contrite, looking as though somebody had jabbed him or something. Apologized. I hadn't heard much of Osterkamp since. But all of a sudden, he started a series of correspondence in this direction. And in the letter that I just read on my desk a moment ago, I catch up with my mail every couple of weeks. He said that advanced procedure was the first comprehensive lineup of psychotherapy that had ever been published anyplace. Now, that's quite remarkable, because here's a man that's been through it all since about 1898. Freud, Jung, Adler, all the rest of this stuff. Phrenology, that's not the right word for it, but I've been through all of this stuff, student of it, practitioner, and so forth. He calls that very definitely to attention. Now, that's perfectly true. It's because nobody had the science of epistemology before that he could make anything out of psychotherapy. The people who are closely associated with psychotherapy continue to think of these procedures and these advances and so forth as wholly in the field of psychotherapy. Of course, to them, everybody is nuts. Actually, these advances here of late are far more significant in the field of general science. They are very workable and significant and do advance psychotherapy, but their sphere of operation is in general science. You take biology. Those boys were out on a raft without a paddle compared to this. just one thing. How do you organize a science? Consequence, you have the biologists, the cytologists, the people in various factors in that field. You have them all at loose ends with one another. They have never said, what's the fundamental of biology? What's the basic in biology? What is the background in biology? What's this all about? Now, how do we go ahead and make a science out of this thing? And the organization of that science is terribly poor. I don't know if you've ever gone in for that particular line of malarkey or not. The boys had some nice answers. The boys figured out this theory of evolution, a fellow by the name of Darwin, and so on. They've spent most of their time arguing about whether or not the theory of evolution was the theory of evolution, was the theory of evolution, instead of trying to figure out why does the theory of evolution have holes in it, why is it not a completely embracing theory, and why does it not agree with the theories underlying cytology, which is the science of cells. They just, no comparative data. There's never been a rundown on that science. Never been a rundown on it. And they call it a science. Look over here and you find sociology. Sociology is about as much of a science as two cats fighting on a back fence. There'd be a professor out at Yale, and there'd be a professor in Los Angeles, they're all Reds out there. But there'd be a professor at Harvard, and it's not because their football teams fight that the one and the other have not even vaguely agreed upon the primary principles of sociology. It is simply because they have all of a sudden come up with something, and they said, see, it's a science. Well, what made it a science? What is the alignment of its data? That's all it amounts to in Dianetics. The second, they had tried to align properly the data of sociology, they would have discovered that tenet 2 did not agree with tenet 10. That one was over here and this one was over here, and that it just didn't add up. Sociology professors, however, make up for this by letting their students go around with flashlights and looked into parked cars suddenly. Nothing like practical experience, they always say, not having a science to teach. Well, the whole field right now looks pretty bright. Because I hit another butt. Got something to talk to you about tonight. Think interesting. You got any cases, any old secondhand, worn-out cases around that are kind of stuck up or something like that? They'll unstick now. Because I laid a terrible goal out. Saying, how good does a psychotherapy, excuse the word, have to be? Well, I said it has to be good enough to resolve a case very, very rapidly. But in particular, it has to be good enough to undo or create at will the phenomena of occlusion and the phenomena of the wide open case and explain them. It has to be able to handle them quickly and without any trouble. Well, a lot of the answer was regret. One looks at regret and he finds out that strange things happen to his visios and his occlusions when he starts to run some regret. Very, very funny though, after he's run quite a bit of regret, something happens. He isn't able to run any more regret. Why? Well, there was a whole mechanical array of data sitting there that had already been predicted in the axioms, and when run into, was found. having been predicted when one saw it, one suddenly realized what he was looking at. What do you know about counter-effort? Effort and counter-effort. Here's an individual puts out an effort, moves something. The counter-effort to that effort is the drag, the friction, so forth, of the table. But we think of counter-effort as something a little more dramatic. Fellow goes, bow! Your effort to keep your jaw from being broken is your effort, and his force to strike it, that is your counter-effort. It's his effort, but your counter-effort. Environmental effort could be referred to. All right, an individual has been constantly in receipt of counter-efforts since the year zero, the hour zero, the minute zero, the second zero. Because the first thing that started him going, evidently, was a counter-effort. Then he took this counter-effort and he turned around and he started to use it against effort. New counter-effort. Boom. But now he used the old counter-effort as his effort, and the new effort went boom. But he used this new counter-effort, and he turned it around, and he made his effort out of it. And the next time he was hit with a counter-effort, why, it went boom. The only reason you're here is because you have handled with relative success all the counter-efforts which have ever hit you. Now, you wouldn't think of it to look at us all beat up the way we are, that we had lived a number of eons, a very large number of eons, in almost continual and consecutive receipt of counter-efforts. And we're still alive. There isn't a person in this room who doesn't go back a billion years or so. Very, very ancient lines. I want to congratulate you on being such ancient lines. Of course, the proof of the matter is you're here. And if you hadn't come up all the way up the line, you wouldn't be here. You see, it's very simple. Now, you see, you've won. Now, maybe a lot of things have happened in the past to individuals or to startings of lines, but they're not here. And they didn't win. And so it kind of changes your orientation when you realize to what degree you were a victor. You take an engram. They get you down the operating table. Doctor sits on you. You take out a saw, a knife, hammer, chisel, feed you some more oxygen, yak, 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 kick you a little bit, knock you off the table. You drop off the stretcher, hit the floor, they put you back on the stretcher again. Run you into bed, neglect you, don't feed you anything, you wake up, you expect a pretty nurse, and you get somebody who probably played opposite Frankenstein. And, that's routine. That's nothing. But you know, of recent years, it's become fashionable for people to insist upon the great importance of importance. There are four buttons on the chart, by the way, which is coming out, which are very interesting buttons. One is, I'm important. Another is, I'm not important. One is, I'm somebody. Another is, I'm nobody. The effort to convince the world that you are important so they won't keep walking on you those hobnails. You don't so much mind the shoes as the hobnails. And they keep walking on you, and so here's your solution. You finally say, but I'm important. I'm valuable. And they don't believe it. They put up signs like a sign I saw in a garage down in Amarillo. I don't know, where is Amarillo? Amarillo, Mexico, or Canada, or something. And it's a town. It's got two tire stores in it and a wrecking yard. Hope nobody hears from Amarillo. The tire, one of the tire stores is very nice, though. cool. It's only 195 in the shade. Well, anyhow, got into Amarillo. And where the hell was I going here?
So that's what comes from putting out too many words.
Leave myself completely high and dry. A little sign on the wall, and it says, if you think you're important, it says, go down to the graveyard and take a look at them there tombstones. A lot of guys down there thought the world couldn't get along without them, too. I think this sign's 1-5. Well, anyhow, they spread a lot of data around about this. They object to people coming around saying, I'm important. Now, when a race gets very old and very aberrated and very down at the heels, it says, I withhold my foul breath from your face. This dishonorable one, this insignificant one, addresses you, worthy sir. They go down at the minus 1.1 propitiation level, and they're very good at it, and so on. But in this society where we are all good, solid, red-blooded Americans, particularly solid, you look over the individuals who are trying to convince you they're important and trying to convince you that you're not important and trying to convince you that they're somebody and that you're nobody. And first thing you know, you pick it up and start doing it too. And you go around in various ways, you say, well, I'm very important. And I do this and I do that, and I am the assistant editor to the associate printer's devil in the high school paper. And look at all these medals I got in the war. Tried to hock mine in San Pedro one night. I was thirsty. And we had run out of money. Fellow offered me $5. And I looked at the $5 and I said, well, I'm not that thirsty, so I hocked my watch instead. But it was a toss-up which one you hocked. Anyhow, point is that when an individual tries to advance something on one dynamic and fails, it hits on the other dynamics. Wouldn't some priest love that if he knew where that eighth dynamic sat there? You said, all right, every time that I fail on the third dynamic, God gets it in the teeth. He'd say, immediately go back and start counting his beads rapidly. But the point is, he hasn't got any evidence. You know, I've never seen anybody in any church yet that was struck by lightning. I've never seen the roof fall in, except with a man-made shell. And I've seen people sit in church and not get struck by lightning, and I knew the people. So there's something about man in the eighth dynamic that we don't quite know about. It's quite obviously a prime mover unmoved, quite obviously. Anyway, you go around and you start saying to people, I'm important. Little kid, look, Mama, look what I'm doing. Look, I can walk on this fence with one finger. To the little girls, I'm important. Look how many handsprings I can turn. So on, you get all of this stuff added up, added up, added up, until one day somebody doesn't think the guy's important. Then he goes in and he earnestly pleads with them to believe that he's important. They still don't believe him. Poor guy, he's stuck right there. He has tried to convince other people that he's important. He failed, so he has to convince himself. Now he's got to convince himself that he's important. He convinces himself that he is important. And in order to set a good example, he starts considering other people important. And he starts considering their opinions important. Therefore, after that, he will listen to criticism. He started the whole thing himself. Next thing you know, he's believing the 6th grade, the 7th grade, the 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade teachers that he will never be able to ride a bicycle or something, and so he's never able to. They're important. He has to listen to them. Now, that's how the mechanism more or less evolves and comes about. Sooner or later, he's going to go down the tone scale because of all this, and he will hit the level of, I'm not important. He'll do a super failure, particularly when he tries to convince somebody else they're not important. If he tries to convince them long enough and fails to convince them, then he gets not important. It's a wonderful squirrel cage. But that is a manifestation of the serious button. Now you want to know your serious button, people have run this button, and they can see that it's obviously a powerful button. But it has that variation of importance, the serious button. Because if a fellow is important, he has to take himself seriously. And if a fellow considers himself important in order to set a good example and make people believe he is important, he has to pretend that other people are important and that it's very serious for them too. And both of these actions nail down serious as a button. If a person cannot throw off the seriousness of existence and realize it for more or less what it is, if he can't do that one thing, all the psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, not even these great developments, psychology, where they have learned at last how to... See, what did they learn how to do to a rat? No, that subject is worth... They found something out in that subject. They worked at it for about 20, 30 years. Oh, yes, yes. A rat will not stand on an electric plate that has current in it. Yeah. Boy, I'm sure up on my psychology, because there is that one thing to know in the field. It takes a long time to learn it. You can keep putting him on it and he'll keep coming off. By George, if you spent 4 years doing that, you sure know that he won't. Of course, you kill a lot of rats. Well, I wanted to give you that data about that serious button, because that thing works like a dreamboat. All right. Gee whiz, am I going back into high school slang now? Am I sliding back down the time track in present time physiologically or something? Maybe I'm tuned in on the teenagers. I've caught myself doing that now about a half a dozen times in this last week, and I haven't talked to any teenagers. I'm getting suspicious. Well, now I get back to this other. Do you see a relationship between counter-effort, your effort, and your trying to convince somebody of something and failing and getting it back? You see, all you are actually a collection of counter-efforts, really. There is no your effort. There's your thought, but there's only one thought that's yours, and that's prime thought. All the rest of them have efforts behind them. And if you took off all the efforts off of the case, he'd go, pew. He hadn't done it yet, but I think there's 10 to the 20 billionth power efforts probably as a composite in the lifespan of any individual. But you see, you take this counter effort and you throw it over. Use it in order to baffle the next counter effort physically. But if you fail in your use of this counter-effort, the counter-effort becomes a counter-effort again. You didn't handle it. And so it is a counter-effort. You made it your effort. You claimed it for your effort for some time, but all of a sudden, you're not able to use it. It has failed to stop a new counter-effort, and you get it as a counter-effort afterwards. There's no difference between that and this interaction of the nets. Individual tries to convince Joe Blow that he's important. Joe Blow doesn't believe it, and the fellow after that has to think he's important, and then he keeps this up until it's completely proven to them he's not even important. Why, then he has to go on down the line. That's a thought going by the boards, interactive amongst the dynamics. But let's take this very elementary thing. Here you are, your collection of counter efforts, you've used them, you have claimed them, you know what they are, and you take these counter efforts and you baffle new incoming counter efforts with these old counter efforts. You take your shin. Well, you walk along and you hit a chair with your shin, glock. What are you doing? Here, this chair being at rest will oppose to you a counter effort, won't it? What are you baffling it with? You're baffling it with your effort.
Well, yeah,
but what is your effort? Your effort's an old counter-effort that you've conquered. Now, if you find out that every time you bump into a chair, it just hurts you and the chairs never move, you never seem to have any effect on these damn chairs or the table or something of the sort, you're going to get restless after a while because you know you've got a tiger by the tail where your human body is concerned. You know that. Why, people go around all the time, they say, now let me see, I can make myself do this. I think maybe I better make myself do what I tell myself to do in order to make myself do things because I'm not ambitious enough. You go around telling yourself things like this, and finally you come into a point where your body is pretty well under control. And then all of a sudden you find out that some portion of your body, for some reason or other, is never able to move a counter effort. You're going to get something wrong with your shin. If your shin can't kick aside things, so forth, there's something will develop about your shin. What's a psychosomatic illness? It's some old counter effort. Re-stimulated by something you couldn't handle, something you failed at. And you not only recognize that you failed in handling this new counter-effort, you recognize that the old counter-effort that you tried to use to handle this new one, that failed too. Well, every psychosomatic illness has two parts. Every one I've monkeyed with to date always has. Not too long ago, I was wondering why this was, why there was a new failure and an old failure in terms of efforts. Only one of these psychosomatics can keep up, and there can be a variety of old ones. But the point is, they're old. Now, you can't find a psychosomatic illness on an individual today which hasn't failed him. That is an old, old counter-effort that he has used to handle some new counter-effort and failed. So the new counter-effort is very painful to him mentally or something of the sort, and the old counter-effort's painful to him physically, and they'll be pinned right together just as nice as you please. And the reason why you have a hard time, if you do, taking apart these darn things is because you've generally got an emotional charge having to do with failure lying on top of something that's back there in the caves or something that's way back a lot of the time on these psychosomatic ills. So you look at a human being, you find some portion of his anatomy is aberrant. physically aberrated. It's taken the form of a psychosomatic illness. Well, let's say it's dermatitis, something like that. You look at this fellow, he's got dermatitis. Well, that dermatitis that he's got is one of two things. It's either an old somatic. It is both of two things, but I mean these are the composite sides of it. It's an old somatic of some sort. And it's a failure, relatively recent failure, this lifetime failure. Dermatitis, we look at this, we say, grandma died. Grandma died of some kind of a skin infection. She did have something wrong with her left hand. All right. All we've got to do is pick up grandma's death and it'll go away. That's perfectly true. But why has this darn thing been so stubborn? And we try to pick it up and you can blow charges all over the case, but you can't blow grandma's death. Well, it must have been a rugged one if it made a mark. This person is trying to carry out grandma's goals. This person is obviously there. Well, you try to run sympathy. You don't get very far. You can run a little bit of it. You try to run regret at grandma's death. Well, you get a little bit of that. But then you run approval. Something on that order. If you can get any early approval. What's approval? Approval is somebody else saying you're important. That'll ruin a guy right there. You're important, approval is saying. And he got a lot of approval from grandma. But you start examining this somatic. You expect it immediately to go away, and it doesn't go away, and you find out that all the data seems to be lost in this thing. Well, of course it's lost. It's in the middle of a bunch of counter-efforts. I don't care how old these counter-efforts are. The data is all messed into these counter-efforts, and believe me, those counter-efforts have more data in them, which is just as serious as grandma's death, and therefore an auditor, if he strikes one of these super combinations that he can't just explode, it's simply that formula. That's the formula. It's a this life failure which has made a person lose control of yesterday's counter effort. Now you see how thought and action interplay. Well, how do you resolve it? You start monkeying around with the efforts on that hand. And you start blowing data into view. You're liable to blow almost anything into view. And at any moment, you'll think, well, I'll have this resolved. Bing. But you keep getting more data, more this. And all of a sudden, you find out about grandma, and you try to run grandma. And you run through thing a few times, and then all of a sudden, you find out that you can get some more counter-efforts off the thing. You jockey back and forth. All of a sudden, the pre-clear says to you, I don't want to be processed anymore. Oh. No, I think I'll keep my epiphlusis. It's been a comfort to me all these years. Well, the case was being run just a little bit too hot. And the thing which you neglected to take off of it was sympathy and I'm important. The hand represented approval one way or another. On some of these psychosomatic ills, you get something like this. If you went up to some soldier who was gimping along and on a government pension, didn't have anything, in other words, and he's gimping along and You said, now to make you well, we're going to have to take you off your Congressional Medal of Honor. You just ain't going to get no Congressional Medal of Honor off this man.
No, sir.
There is something about approval. That's all a Congressional Medal of Honor is. It says, we approve of you. You're important. Somebody who didn't know his history said Napoleon invented the medal. And Napoleon really knew how to handle men's desire for importance and knew how to pay them off with these here medals, and that he invented them and so forth. That doesn't happen to be true. A fellow by the name of George E. Washington invented them. First of them was the Purple Heart. Look how that's degenerated. If you can manage to get yourself wounded, we give you a medal. All you accident prones is going to get decorated, Miss Wall. The rest of you guys that really got something on the ball, you managed to miss all them darn bullets. We ain't going to decorate you. But that, in essence, is a psychosomatic illness. It's many of them. Of course, you understand I'm talking about tough psychosomatic illnesses. Matter of fact, you can take a little bit of effort processing or get a guy to sneeze a couple of times, and sometimes something that the great legions of medicine working in their white coats in the biochemist laboratories, I never could figure out how the medical doctors always got into that category, because the boys who do the research in that field happen to be chemists, and they give this stuff over to these technicians. The doctor takes, read through the literature, turns it over, looks it over a couple times, sees a nice picture, says, that's a nice microscope, I'd like to have a microscope like that. Well, this is spliceomycin, and this heals broken legs. And he sticks a needle into the bottle, goes, gets a big shot of it, and boom, the preclear goes, boom, I mean the patient, and they bury him. Doctor says, I wonder what was wrong with this. The first headlines came out in the Beacon. New miracle drug cures. That's always what they say. New miracle drug, oh, that's gorgeous. You just wait for the next story. It's no wonder doctors don't believe anything about this particular science, is because they're such damn liars. It's like trying to get a horse trainer to believe you're trying to trade him a good horse. He didn't believe it. Well, anyway, this new miracle drug then does a spin in the news, and you find new miracle drug is found not to be working well anymore. New miracle drug only cures 1/100th of 1% of its cases instead of the 99 and 44/100ths previously advertised. The main reason that happens is because the medico, he's busy. He's got a tongue depressor, little kid. Say, yeah, got measles, take it home. Yeah, so on. You know, one after the other. Oh, yes, my dear Mrs. Zilch, all you had to do is go on to cut out all of the carbohydrates and get lots of carbohydrates, Bye. Next fellow comes along and he says, well, you're one of these high-powered individuals, aren't you? Now, what you want to do is rest, relax, and control yourself. Now, you've got to take it easy. You've got to learn how to take it easy and learn how to live with that ulcer. In a few years, if you don't take care of that ulcer, and if you don't relax, rest, take it easy, sit down quietly, and let all the counter-somatics hit you, we'll be having to cut it out. Hey, come think about why that. Yeah, that's right. She didn't want. Say, by the way, I was saying about that ulcer. There's this new operation. Off to the races. He doesn't have time to read the literature. And very strange things happen to these drugs. But anyhow, it's off the subject, or is it? These new drugs, when they get thrown into taking the guy's Congressional Medal of Honor away from him and taking his Purple Heart away from him. They just don't work. But if they do happen to work on that, the individual's always got another angle on the same incident, by the way, the same incident that he can bring to view, which occasioned the people in the field of psychotherapy to say that, well, every time it's no use continuing on, there's nothing to study, there's no data at all, no more phenomena than we have discovered, except maybe all the phenomena, of which we've discovered none. Every time you take a disease away from somebody or a psychosomatic illness away from somebody, he immediately gets another one. They say, well, there's no use treating them. Well, if you force one to suppress parts of this, you can move the guy a little bit on the track, you see, and move him into some other counter-effort batch or do something with him. All right. You can't take penicillin, oreomycin, spinabilin, metrozillin, or any one of these things and cure grandma's sympathy with it. For some peculiar reason, when you work on the physical side of the ledger, in the belief that men can't think and have no emotions, that so a miracle drug will always remain just that, a miracle drug. And the beacon can go on filling up four columns with it. By the way, the same day that the beacon was invited over to see this little girl down from Indiana who was walking again, they had a miracle drug story. And yesterday, New Dispatch canceled it as usual. They found out that it was very bad, that it killed men or something. They're sure awful busy with medicine. Well, anyhow, one of the finest cures that you can possibly lay your hands on, if you want somebody to get well from a cold or something like that, don't give a person Vicks VapoBeacon or something. Keep all the sympathetic people away from them. Keep all these sympathetic people away, and the person will recover fairly rapidly. Because sympathy is saying this. Sympathy is saying you're important. And I sympathize with you. And I approve of your cold. It's saying this. I approve of your cold. I approve of you. I like you. I hope you get better. Oh, you poor dear. I hope you get better. He's been working for this all his life. Mama said, bah! Yes, dear. And Grandma said, well, you can't wear your new shoes, because if you wear your new shoes, why, then your bicycle, and besides, you left it in the street, and after all, and here's a dollar, and it's all yours to do whatever you like with, as long as you go down and get a haircut. And Father said, no, you've got to uphold the honor of this family. You've got to uphold the honor of this family because we Snides have always been something in the community, and therefore we expect a great deal of you. And the reason I'm spending all this money upon you and sending you to school is because we Snides have always done this. And you're important, and you've got to live up to being important. The guy starts saying, but I'm not. I'm not important. Anyway, this is the level of approval this fellow's gotten. And all of a sudden, one day, he unfortunately has a cold, and somebody comes along and says to him, you poor fellow. Gee, nice cold. Look what it got me, nice Purple Heart. Well, how are you going to cure a person of doing that? You start running sympathy all up and down the line. Sooner or later, you're going to run into his brutality and his regret, and then you'll run into this confounded I'm important button. Because the individual, all geared up to resist counter-effort, particularly geared up to resist counter-effort which might occur while he's flat on his back. That's a dangerous time for any counter effort to appear, by the way, when you're incapacitated. You'll find quite a few sick people sort of sick this way, because they're lying quietly, they are impressible, counter efforts can hit them easily, and old past counter efforts are hitting them easily, and all of a sudden you make the guy desire the moment by giving him approval. All of a sudden you say, this is the moment. You stick him right on the track. Just like nearly anybody is stuck at the moment he got a Congressional Medal of Honor. He stuck there a little bit. He likes to think about this once in a while. Of course he goes right there. Nothing. Nothing. I keep it home in the wastebasket. But you stick him with a pro. He's capable of receiving any kind of an effort. You tell him at once, I like you. You tell him at once, I am sympathetic towards you. That is to say, I have a feeling for you when you're this way. You are important. It is too bad. You, as another member of the human race, are sick, and therefore it's too bad because you must be important to things. And the reason he's probably just a little bit sick is because he's already got one of these going, like grandma's death and dermatitis. Also latches up on birth, also latches up somewhere down the line. Grandma has taken his hand and has extracted a splinter from it, or has fixed it up when it was scraped. He had this terrible fall off of this tricycle, all of 1 foot down to the pavement, and he scraped the skin off of his hand, and Grandma says, too bad. I'm so sorry. Let me kiss it and make it well, you poor little fellow. Well, that's a very brave little boy, not crying that way. Grandma dies. The fellow desperately regrets Grandma's death. Grandma happens to have dermatitis. Now, for some reason or other, he's got a whole chain of chronic somatics on a hand that he has not been able to handle. All right? He keeps extending this, or extending his whole being in the direction of this moment, trying to pull back an interchange of sympathy, life, and approval. And of course, right in the midst of it, Grandma dies, and that's complete failure. There is no more complete failure than to see yourself looking at a stiff. That's right, crudely enough. If you try to bring some animal, some human being, back to life, you try to breathe the breath of life into them, you hope nothing's going to happen to them, something of the sort, and you fail. Well, that's the biggest failure there is, because that's the whole length of the tone scale. Boom! At the moment you try it, you're completely self-sacrificing. You're way up there in the stars. You're all set. You do anything to bring this person back to life. Well, you're moving way up there when you start this sort of thing, and then all of a sudden somebody says, dead. Quick fall in too little time, that's what it is. It's just maximal failure. A person's effort at such a moment, even when he starts to receive the news that somebody is dead, he'll go through this whole thing. Oh, if I could only do something. It's my fault. I should have been there. I should have... I knew if I didn't pray for him every night, he would die. I knew I forgot to, and on and on and on. A guy will try to whip this thing up and get the time. What he's trying to do is like one of these cats in a cartoon. You know, when the cat stops, you hear the tires screech. Go on, it's not important. I fed you all into grief charges. Come on, President. And the fellow's trying to get back there to a moment when he could do something about this, see? Now, you as the auditor, you say,
present time.
No! He's still back there trying to back up time and so forth. Now, if I could only have been there, if I could have done this, he's got this terrific unsolved computation. The computation is simply, why did grandmother have to die? Why did she have to die? What was this all about? If I had done something different earlier, would she now be alive? See, it's computationally, this thing is all fouled up. Because grandma's a source of approval or something like that, and a fellow will carry a token of a psychosomatic ill. You carry a token, just like somebody will like a girl wear an engagement ring. It's a token. Somebody loves me. So you can carry this psychosomatic that belongs to grandma, or the face shape that belongs to grandpa, or almost anything along that line. Pets, dogs, anything of the sort. But it's always trying to solve this one problem. Why do you have to die? It isn't self-pity, it's just the fact that a fellow goes all out to help and then fails. Well, you've processed a lot of this. There's the formula. The formula for getting this undone is very simple. You pick up the sympathy, the approval, the feeling of importance the person gave you. You pick up all of this various emotional line and that psychosomatic blow. And that's all there are to it. It's gone. And the net result, you will leave the psychosomatic either not necessary to run, or you will leave it in a condition that with just a very little bit of effort, there's nothing, it'll go. But unless you solve those problems lying around on top of it, there are psychosomatics around which won't resolve any more than a soldier will give you his congressional medal of honor. That's sympathy, approval, and so on. The second half of this lecture, I'm going to show you, demonstrate to you, something that you'll be able to use, which will crack the emotion off of any case. We never knew this about emotion before. But there's another segment of emotion that we didn't know anything about, and which makes the segment we do know about sticky, so that it's hard to handle. So let's take a break.